Today, volatility rules. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 5th of October 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I'll be your guide through the past week's news digest, a week in which markets were up and down, trade disputes escalated, and locally the RBA cut the cash rate, once again underscoring the weakening economy here, while banks kept much of the drop for themselves. And as usual, I'll start with the international scene as our open trade-driven economy remains highly exposed to what's happening abroad. But if you want to jump directly to the Australian section, the time is shown below, and I'll also include a table of contents and timings in the comments below. Globally, Fitch Ratings this week said they foresaw the slowest growth in 8 years ahead due to the escalation of the US-China trade wars. And they said there can be few precedents since the 1930s of global growth prospects being affected so significantly by trade policy disruptions. Their world GDP growth forecasts for both 2019 and 2020 have been lowered by 0.2 percentage points since their June analysis in response to the sharp escalation in the US-China trade war over the summer. Global growth is projected now to fall to 2.6% this year and to 2.5% next year from 3.2% in 2018. This would be the slowest pace of expansion since 2012, when the Eurozone crisis was at its peak. And the current global slowdown is highly synchronized, with 19 out of 20 countries covered in their analysis slowing. China's 2020 growth forecast has been revised down to 5.7% from 6%, and the Eurozone forecast has been cut to 1.1% from 1.3% in June. The US 2020 forecast has also been lowered by 0.1 percentage points to 1.7%. The U-turn in global monetary policy direction was completed in the third quarter 19, they say, with two interest rate cuts from the Fed, one interest rate cut from the ECB, and the ECB announcement of a restart of quantitative easing asset purchases on an open-ended basis. Global central banks have delivered the most rapid and geographically broad-based shift to monetary policy easing since 2009, Fitch said. And there are also doubts as to how effective monetary easing can be in an environment of sharply rising trade policy uncertainty and its deleterious impact on business investment. And we discussed the implications of lower rates in our recent post, The Real Problem with Low Interest Rates. Indeed, the markets were much exercised this week by the fate of the US economy. Earlier in the week, a string of disappointing economic data fueled concerns a slowdown in manufacturing could spread to the consumer. The September non-manufacturing index came in at 52.6, compared with an expected 55, and that's a three-year low. We saw a two-day losing streak that reached 3% in the S&P 500 index on Thursday. And given the yield curve inversion between the three-month and the 10-year, which has predicted the past seven recessions, the markets ratcheted up bets that the Fed will reduce rates this month. But then the market turned as the Labour Department reported non-farm payrolls increased by 136,000 last month, and the US unemployment rate dropped to a 50-year low, despite slightly missing estimates for September, while August's reading was revised up. Actually, the market rally was largely computer-driven. The uniformity of the gains and the speed with which they occurred was a clear signal of across-the-board blanket buying. But one analyst said, it's sort of a Goldilocks report. It's not strong enough to move the Federal Reserve away from cutting rates at the end of October, but it's not weak enough to make you concerned about the labour market or the consumer. But we say don't be fooled. The labour market is weakening and not improving. While the data suggests that the economy is at full employment, hence the moderation in job growth, the slowdown in the services and manufacturing areas poses a major risk to hiring in the months ahead. The services sector going downhill with the manufacturing sector is a much bigger deal, as it accounts for nearly 90% of the US economy. This fall in service sector activity points to widening fallout from the US-China trade wars. Now, traders trimmed their bets on the results, but the odds still favoured a Fed rate cut this month. In fact, Chair Jerome Powell did little to change the speculation, saying on Friday, the economy, quote, faces some risks, but is overall, quote, in a good place. Traders see a 77.5% chance that the central bank will be lowering borrowing costs at its policy meeting later this month, which is up from 40% last Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 1.42% to close at 26,573, while the S&P 500 also surged 1.42%, finishing at 2,952. All major sector indices rose, led by a 1.9% jump in the S&P Financials Index, which closed at 447.03. The Nasdaq Composite added 1.4% to end at 7,982. A rally in technology stocks led by Apple also helped lift the benchmark index at the end of a rollercoaster week. Apple shares rose 2.8% after a report that the company would ramp up production of iPhone 11 models. But during Friday's session, HP fell 9.6% after the computer maker said that it would cut up to 16% of its workforce as part of a restructuring plan that would result in an overall charge of $1 billion. The 10-year Treasury rate dropped for the seventh session in a row to 1.531% from Thursday's 1.536%, though the 2-year Treasury yield picked up on the back of the payrolls report. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 10.88% to 1704. Gold futures for December delivery was down 0.23% to 1,510, but is still up 0.4% on the week. And crude oil for delivery in November rose 1.01% to 52.98. The euro-US dollar was up 0.13% to 1.0978, and the US dollar index futures was down 0.03% to 98.51. Bitcoin closed at $8,229, down more than 22% in the past month, although up 0.14% on the day. Volumes on US exchanges was light at 5.9 billion shares, compared with the average of 7.3 billion over the last 20 trading days. For the week, the S&P 500 fell 0.3%, the Dow lost 0.9%, and the Nasdaq added 0.5%. For a third consecutive week, the Dow and the S&P 500 lost ground. In fact, as the dollar declined, the S&P 500 rose the most in 7 weeks, though still suffered its third weekly loss. Investors should keep an eye on trade headlines as well, because on Friday, President Trump said he sees, quote, a very good chance of a trade deal with China. Still, the Trump's administration pushes on, but to what end, we ask? Ostensibly to enhance the US economy and create jobs, but so far, the policy seems to be delivering the exact opposite. It's likely the Fed will ease again when they do meet in October, on the 31st, in fact. Amid this scenario, it's no wonder that long bets in the US dollar have evaporated this week, with the Canadian dollar markdown phase even more dramatic, partly due to the strong correlation between the two North American currencies, which also plays into the view that sooner or later the Canadian economy will be hit by the slowdown in the US, which will force the Bank of Canada to ease policy in line with the global theme that we're seeing. And next week's labour market report will be therefore exceptionally important. There was more poor economic data out of the Eurozone on Thursday. This time, it was the final services PMI, coming surprisingly lower than the flash estimates. As in the case of the US, the manufacturing contagion spillover is feeding into services. In France, the services PMI came in at a five-month low. In Germany, it stands at the lowest it's been in over 3 years. And in Spain, the subcomponent of the outlook is at a five-year low, just to name a few. The euro traded higher against the US dollar 4 out of the 5 last trading days, and a large part of the move had to do with the weaker US dollar. The sell-off in the dollar and expectations for Fed easing, but the outlook for the region is dim, especially after the US imposed fresh tariffs on the EU this week. Indeed, the Trump administration on Wednesday rolled out new tariffs on European Union goods that will go into effect on October the 18th. The announcement followed a decision by the World Trade Organization that gave the US approvals to impose new tariffs. Duties on a range of goods from Italian cheese, French wine, Spanish olives to British biscuits will increase to 25%. Retaliatory tariffs are expected, and when they're announced, will most likely drive the euro lower. And next week's economic reports include Germany's factory orders, industrial production, and trade balance reports. Elsewhere, India pulled the trigger on another rate cut on Friday, the fifth in the cycle so far. Next week will be an important one for sterling. October the 11th is the deadline for the UK to deliver an acceptable exit proposal. Unfortunately, it seems that the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is moving further away from crafting an agreement with changes substantial enough for the EU to reopen negotiations. On Friday, Johnson sent over his final proposal, which included mild and not major concessions. Ireland still reportedly said there are huge issues, while the EU President Tusk told Boris Johnson, "We remain open but still unconvinced," echoing similar concerns by EC President Juncker, who said, "A number of problematic points remain in the proposal, with further work needed by the UK." Sterling traded in a tight range through the week against the US dollar and now hangs in the balance. Many believe the proposal will be rejected by the EU, which could send the currency tumbling lower. And data last week was mixed, with the manufacturing PMI index rising, but the services and construction index falling. However, activity in all three sectors are contracting, which underscores the weakness in the UK economy. The FTSE closed at 7,155, up 1.1% on the day, but down 3.65% over the week. The financials index was also up by 1.3%, though down 2.95% over the week to 721. Metro Bank continues to languish, though its shares jumped by more than a quarter on Wednesday, following its founders quitting in the wake of a major accounting error, and investors backed a new fundraising effort for the embattled lender. Vernon Hill, Metro's chairman, will leave the board by the end of the year as the bank continues to deal with the fallout from a major accounting error. The announcement came as Metro launched a fresh bond sale, initially worth £300 million. That's a week after pulling a similar offer due to lack of interest from investors. Wednesday's bond sale was oversubscribed, allowing the bank to raise £350 million, although at a steeper interest rate of 9.5%. The bank needed to raise money to meet regulators' capital requirements, and its independent survival is certainly not guaranteed. Lastly, the yen held firm as one of the main beneficiaries of the woes in the US's Purchase Managers Index, while the Swiss franc has gone through a whole different phase. Depressed ever since the major miss in Switzerland's CPI on Wednesday, raising the alarm bells of lower rates by their national bank. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so, to the local market. Although the Reserve Bank lowered interest rates for the third time this year, the Aussie dollar benefited from US dollar weakness, stronger manufacturing and services PMI, and positive trade headlines. The New Zealand dollar followed the Aussie dollar higher, as there were no major economic reports from New Zealand on the calendar. But Australian retail sales for August were pretty lame after a poor showing in July. We discussed this in our post, both mortgage stress and retail take a breather. Discretionary spending is on the rocks, and the latest trade figures, which were still strong, had been hit by lower iron ore prices and easing volumes. The evidence continues to mount for weaker growth ahead as both households and businesses hunker down. The property market is centre stage, with many claiming a significant rebound in Sydney and Melbourne, but we should not be too hasty, as according to my interview with Nerida Connersby from the REA, their data is simply not validating the CoreLogic recovery claims. This is because low volumes are distorting the markets. This is what she said.
Okay, so that sales data interests me because obviously with the low volumes that are currently going through in terms of, you know, auction clearance rates and transaction throughput, the price data appears to be quite strong. I guess my question is that true, or is it actually a function of the more limited volumes and therefore the limited data streams that are coming through?
Oh, absolutely. The volumes has a lot to do with that at the moment. I mean, we're not seeing growth in Melbourne and Sydney as yet. So I think some forecast or some creators of indices are seeing strong growth in Melbourne and Sydney at the moment. We're not. We are still seeing price declines, but we are seeing some suburbs do very, very well. And the suburbs that are doing well tend to be premium suburbs. It's premium Sydney in particular. We are seeing strong growth in places like Fort Clues and Collaroy and Rose Bay, for example. Some strong growth in Gold Coast premium, so which I think is related to Sydney money. We can certainly see search moving from Sydney up to the Gold Coast. So premium markets are doing pretty well. It is pretty... And auction clearance rates, you know, that's another one that tends to be a little bit misleading, because if you have a look at auction numbers and where auctions take place, they are mainly in Sydney and Melbourne, and they're mainly Sydney and Melbourne premium. So, you know, we've got these very high auction clearance rate, these auction clearance rates, but at the same time, if you have a look at a market like Sydney, listing volumes are down 25% compared to the same time last year. So there's a distinct lack of property on the market, which, you know, is one of the key drivers of price growth.
And as several industry insiders point out, CoreLogic has lost a critical data feed from the REA. So they are now very reliant on direct industry input to calculate their oft-quoted hedonic index. Yet prices are not disclosed on around 1/3 of sales. So perhaps we should be cautious about reading too much into their numbers. What we do know is that small volumes of high-value homes are in play. Indeed, CoreLogic said, after recording the largest losses during the recent housing market downturn, the premium end of Sydney and Melbourne's housing market is driving the rebound in capital gains. In Sydney and Melbourne, it's clearly the prestige end of the markets that is driving the strongest capital gains, with values up 4.2% and 4.6% over the September quarter across top quartile of the market. This was also the sector that recorded the largest decline during the down phase, with Sydney's top quartile properties remaining 13.6 below their previous peak, while Melbourne's top quartile properties are still 11.9% below their peak. But we also know that unit prices and property in the outer urban ring are still falling. And these are the places where mortgage stress is rampant, with our latest data showing 1.07 million households in stress. We published mapping down to a postcode level this week. An SQM research showed that the volume of properties listed for sale continues to fall, which is directly opposite to what would be expected in the normal spring cycle. And we also saw the RBA credit data come out, and it was weak, which confirms data from industry that the volume of mortgages being written are still way down, despite weaker lending standards now back in vogue. And UBS this week also said that their survey indicated more households were receiving liar loans than before the Royal Commission. Perhaps this is not surprising given the detail now being requested. See our post, Liar Loans and a Housing Bubble, where I discuss this on ABC Radio. The CoreLogic auction results continue to come in strong on clearance rates, but low on volumes. And remember, the counts are distorted this weekend and last by the school holidays and finals.
According to CoreLogic, Melbourne has an 80% clearance rate, but only on 107 listed auctions and 69 sales, which is pretty meaningless. I'm amazed the media just parrot the results without any comprehension. This is frankly deceptive. Now, their daily price index also showed more upswing. So now, looking at the CoreLogic index to the 3rd of October 2019, in Sydney, prices rose 0.45% over the last week. Over the quarter, they're up 3.7%. Annually, they've fallen 4.6%. And from peak, they're down 11.8%. In Melbourne, they're up 0.35% over the last week. They're up 3.54% over the quarter. They've fallen 3.7% over the last year, and from peak they're down 7.8%. In Brisbane, they rose 0.06% over the last week. Over the quarter, they're up 0.66%. Annually, they've fallen 1.9%, and from peak they're down 2%. In Adelaide, prices rose 0.15% over the last week. They've fallen 0.64% over the quarter. They've fallen 1.1% over the last year, and from peak they're down 1.6%. In Perth, prices rose 0.19% over last week. They fell 1.77% over the quarter. They're down 9% annually. And from peak, they're down 21.3%. And over the five majors, the weekly rise was 0.32%. Over the quarter, up 2.43%. Annually, they've fallen 4.4%. And from peak, they're down 8.6%. And we can also look at the annual price movements, again, based on the CoreLogic series. And we can see there that Sydney prices really started to move up, according to CoreLogic, in early August. And they continue to climb. A similar story is also evident in Melbourne. Whereas in Brisbane, there's very little movement. And in Adelaide as well. And in Perth, prices are still quite low, close to 10% down over the last year. But the five cities index is also continuing to rise. And as I've said before, and we'll say again, these are average price movements, and particular properties in particular locations may not be following these trends. In fact, this may well be quite misleading, considering the low volumes of transactions going through the system at the moment. But nevertheless, CoreLogic continues to report, and so we will continue to report their data. Australia's competition regulator said that it was considering an investigation into the banking sector. That's less than a year after a public inquiry exposed widespread wrongdoing and led to billions of dollars in costs for the industry. The Sydney Morning Herald reported the ACCC was planning a fresh inquiry into barriers to entry in retail banking, a sector dominated by the country's big four banks. The regulator confirmed that an inquiry was under consideration and said it was considering which stakeholders to engage with, but declined to give details. They are facing increased regulatory scrutiny after the sector-wide Royal Commission inquiry last year found that they'd pursued profit ahead of customers' interests. A separate inquiry by the Productivity Commission also found the sector lacked competition. The four banks have booked expenses of well over 8 billion Aussie dollars to refund customers for overcharged fees, missold products, and non-compliant financial advice in the wake of the Royal Commission, with NAB this week doubling its compensation pot. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg said he would give a new inquiry's consideration, but added, "Right now, I'm not focused on new inquiries." Prime Minister Scott Morrison said earlier this week that he was disappointed in the major banks for denying borrowers the full benefit of the latest central bank monetary easing. Westpac Banking Corporation and Australia and New Zealand Banking Group joined the country's other big four lenders in skipping the chance to pass on the central bank's cut in full to customers due to ever-thinning margins. Westpac and ANZ's decision on Wednesday comes despite pressure from the country's Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, to do so after the Reserve Bank of Australia lowered its benchmark cash rate to an all-time low of 0.75% on Tuesday in an attempt to kickstart the economy. However, analysts have warned that the three rate cuts this year and further central bank easing may inflict even more pain on Australian banks' net interest margins. Westpac said that it would lower variable home loan interest rates by 15 basis points, while ANZ said it would be lowered by 14 basis points. The move follows similar reductions by Commonwealth Bank of Australia and National Australia Bank hours after the RBA's cut. CBA lowered its standard owner-occupied variable rate by 13 basis points, while NAB lowered it by 15 basis points. The banks have argued that they face a difficult balancing act with rates approaching zero, which has raised questions about the effectiveness of super easy monetary policy. The top four lenders have resisted public pressure in the past to fully pass on the earlier two central bank cuts to customers. And in addition, Commonwealth Bank of Australia's life insurance arm has been charged with 87 counts of unlawfully offering to sell products via unsolicited telephone calls, the first criminal prosecution against a major bank following a sector-wide misconduct inquiry. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission has accused Colonial Mutual Life Insurance Society Limited, known as CommInsure, of unlawfully selling life insurance policies via unsolicited phone calls between October and December 2014. CBA could be fined as much as $21,250 Australian dollars for each charge, or up to $1.8 million, the regulator says in a statement, adding the matter was being prosecuted by the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions. CBA agreed to sell its life insurance business to Hong Kong-based AIA Group in September 2017, but the deal has yet to be completed due to a prolonged regulatory approval process. CBA said in a statement it would be considering the matter and did not plan to comment further at this time. The ASX was up 0.36% to close at 5,400. The financials index was down a tad to 6,207, and the local volatility index was down 2.74% to 1580. ANZ closed at 2717, down 0.48%. CBA was down 0.32% to 77.59, despite the ASIC move, and NAB fell 0.54% to 27.85, and Westpac fell 0.28% to 28.42. The Aussie recovered to 67.70, up 0.45%, having dropped below 67 on a stronger US dollar earlier in the week. The euro Aussie was at 1.6215, down 0.28%, and the gold Aussie cross was at 2,223, down 9.32%. The Aussie Bitcoin cross was down 0.24% to 12,162 and down 21.9% over the past month. So we think the market volatility will continue, and news on the US-China trade talks will be one key determinant. But I want to end with a brief clip from an analyst who has looked at the correlation between the yield curve inversions and recessions, and he believes the US will be hit ahead.
You know, obviously, 30 years ago, you observed this phenomenon of inverted yield curves preceding recessions. We've had some curves still in inversion, 3-month, 10-year. 2-10 is positive. When you look at the sort of the structure of the curve right now, is how serious of a warning do you see for the economy, even ignoring the data that we're getting?
Yeah, so importantly, my dissertation, 1986, looked at 10-year minus 3-month.
Okay.
So
which
that
is still
inverted
an inversion
for a
today.
Quarter June 30th. So we're looking at 2 quarters of inversion.
Yeah.
At the time of my dissertation, I had a 4-for-4 record, and people are pretty skeptical because only 4 observations.
Right.
And then afterwards, to my surprise, I had inversions before the next 3 recessions and no false signals. So that's important. 7-for-7, no false signals, and now we're code red. We have an inversion effectively for 2 quarters. It's really hard to ignore.
As I've said several times, 2020 looks like the critical year. And if the US goes, so will we. Remember that we are already in a per capita recession, as the US Fed reminded us this week. And across the aisle, from John Adams to Chris Joy, they say if a recession hits, home prices will fall. You have been warned. Before I go, a quick reminder that our next live streaming event will be on the 15th of October at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can join the real-time chat or send me a question via the DFA blog ahead of time. Given the risks in the system, and October is often the killer month, this should be an interesting show. I hope to see you there. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.